Well, I've often talked fondly about my days as a parish pastor. I remember, now, see, time does have a tendency to make these things somewhat romantic, but I remember being blissfully happy as a parish pastor, so blissfully happy. There were many weeks I would say to anyone who would listen, I can't believe they're paying me to do this. And there are times, I'll be quite honest with you, as much as I enjoy sitting behind this microphone, I would gladly many days trade it to go right back to the parish and serve there as a parish pastor. But what do parish pastors do? What's the job? The old joke, of course, is that pastors only work one day a week, and it is an old joke and certainly a joke, but where does it come from? Does it come from perhaps a misunderstanding or a failure to understand exactly what the pastor's job, if you can call it that, is? We're going to talk about the work of a Christian pastor for the next half hour of Issues Etc. Pastor Greg Olms joins us in about 25 minutes. Bob Leko will join us to talk about the Signs and Wonders movement in the third hour. We'll be talking with Dr. Richard Stuckwish about Justin Martyr, remembered this day by the church, and rounding off today's program with a little bit of audio open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Greg Olms is a regular guest here on the program. He is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Catawba, North Carolina, author of the blog Incarnatus Est, and he's also written an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled In His Stead. Pastor Olms, welcome back.
Hey, Todd, thank you. Good to be here.
What exactly is a pastor's job, if we can talk about it as a job?
Well, the job of a pastor really in the end is to preach the gospel or to deliver the gospel, if you will, and that's his central task. That's what he's called to do. That's what the scriptures give him to do. And that, of course, would happen on Sunday, the one day he works. But he does a lot of other things, but all of those other things are in service to or are in some way related to or a help in that central job or task, which is to preach the gospel, to forgive sins in the ways in which Christ has given to the church and to the pastor to do.
Well, the old joke then seems to have, at least at its in the kernel of truth, some merit if the pastor is essentially a proclaimer preacher. Would it surprise you then, Pastor Olms, that joke persists about the pastor only working one day a week?
No, that was a very nice way of introducing the topic that you had, because, right, there's a kernel of truth there that, you know, what the pastor does, you know, what he's there for in the end really is Sunday morning, or of course there are other times when there are services, but, you know, that central time when he, you know, he preaches the gospel, when he baptizes, when he gives the Lord's Supper, you know, that really is the role of the pastor as the scriptures have it, as our Lord would have it. And so, yeah, there's, you know, I don't know when the people who are saying it, you know, I don't know if that's what they're about, but I think, you know, there is a kernel of truth there.
Now, let's talk about what is attached to that central task, the central task to preach and to teach, to administer the sacraments that Christ has given his church. But along with that comes an awful lot of things. And I remember the day of my ordination promising to do a lot of things like visit the sick and the dying, to comfort people, to preach and to teach the young and the old, and all sorts of other things that that I ended up doing a lot throughout the course of
sure.
a work week. Talk about those things, Pastor Olms.
Well, the ones you mentioned, all of them really have scriptural roots, and all of them, or scriptural mandates even, and a lot of those that you're speaking of that you've mentioned, the ones that are mentioned in our ordination promises and vows, are in many ways, and at base, really preaching the gospel. I mean, when we say preaching the gospel, we could say preach and teach. And, you know, when I visit a shut-in or when I visit the sick, you know, I'm not there to do social work or, as valuable as that is, I'm not there to do that, but to bring the gospel, you know, to that situation, to that person in that place, and teaching whether it's in Bible class or catechism class or a youth class or a one-on-one situation in the study, whatever it is, you know, a lot of those situations, most of them are instances of bringing Jesus Christ in His Word to a person, to a group of people. And so a lot of what we do as a pastor, even if it's not, excuse me, on Sunday morning, is indeed gospelizing, if you will.
What's changed? Because in the last 100 years or so, Pastor Holmes, the view of the clergy, I think, has changed in the popular mind rather significantly. There was a time when many congregations were rural. Many of the people who were members of most congregations were either semi-professional or probably what we would call today blue-collar workers. The pastor might have been the best educated, one of the best educated people in the community, perhaps. It was considered a profession, like a doctor or a lawyer. And that has changed a lot in recent years. What do you think's brought about that change, the view of the pastor and his work?
Well, that's a good question, and it definitely has. I think the expectations of the pastor have changed a great deal. I think people have brought, and the reasons for this are complex, but the people have brought into the church expectations of their pastor to be other things than what we've been talking about. And some of these things are benign, but when they become the controlling image or the dominant role that the pastor is expected to play, things like, I don't know, leader is a generic term, or visionary, or in those type of things, or administrator, or whatever, then if those expectations get in the way, then there can be some friction, and people start to view the church and the congregation and the parish in ways that are not, you know, dominated by scriptural thought, and so then there's some tension there, I think, and the pastor is expected to be other things, and there can be a lot of tension and conflict between, you know, what his actual role is.
Could it also, or could those be caused by a lower view of the pastor's main task generally in the population? That someone who, quote unquote, merely preaches God's word, that's a luxury, you know. We don't absolutely need that. I mean, we need the bus driver, we need the guy to pick up the trash, we need the doctor, we need the farmer. But these pastors, that's a luxury.
Right, or it's, a luxury, or it's peripheral, or it's something that, you know, anybody can do. Anybody can, you know, forgive sins. Anybody can stand up there and preach. What we really need is somebody, you know, to chart out the future, grow the church, whatever. Yeah, those roles that, of gospel and sacraments and so forth, you know, are looked down on or cast to the side as, you know, just traditions or something we've always done, but, you know, here's this exciting new thing which we really want you to do and we want the parish to do and so forth and so on. And so those get put down at the bottom of the list as almost as taken for granted. Of course we're going to do those things, but, you know, let's spend our time doing these other things which, you know, are more important or more exciting.
What I've noticed along with that, Pastor Holmes, is that more value is placed in the man himself, the man who occupies the office, than in the office he occupies. Congregations start thinking in terms of the quality of the person that they're going to have there, rather than whether or not he will come and necessarily be faithful to that central task of preaching and administering the sacraments. They want the good-looking guy, the young guy, the charismatic guy, the guy with all the new bright ideas who can get people motivated.
Yes, 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 absolutely. The personality cult where it all becomes, and pastors can certainly get seduced by this and can buy into it, you know, when it becomes about, you know, my new ideas and my personality and my ability to get people to volunteer or to give or to engineer a building program or a new program or whatever it is. And it focuses on the, like you say, the man and not the office. And, you know, there's lots of little things in our traditions as Lutherans and lots of things in the scriptures that Christ set up and talked about that are supposed to guard against that. But in our culture of success and largeness and, you know, so many huge corporate churches that have grown up, boy, that's just a real easy temptation. And it's a temptation for the pastor as well as the congregation.
We're talking with Pastor Greg Alms about the work of a Christian pastor. He's pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Catawba, North Carolina, author of the blog Incarnatus Est. And he's also written an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled, In His Stead, on Being Paid to Act Like Jesus. You write this, Pastor Alms, I get paid to do what Jesus did, to preach and forgive and bring the kingdom to sinners. I say the words Jesus said and told us to say. I get paid to play act. What do you mean by that last line?
Play act?
Yes.
Well, it's just kind of a way of getting at that central reality of what a pastor is, the Sunday morning thing, if you will, and even if it's not a Sunday morning thing, but the gospel and the sacraments, and that is, and it ties into what the question you just asked me about. It's not the person, it's the office. When a pastor is being a pastor, he's delivering Jesus to the people in the ways in which Jesus said, you know, here, I'm going to be here, do these things. And so play acting means, you know, it's not Greg Alms here doing Greg Alms things, but I'm fulfilling the role, so to speak, that Christ has given me, because Christ has commanded and promised that in these roles, in these words, in these things, here is forgiveness, here is my presence. And so, a pastor takes up those roles, those actions, those words, and he does them, and he's not, you know, play act, maybe poor choice of words, but what it gets at is it's not me, it's I'm doing what Christ has told me to do, and don't pay attention to me, but you know, pay attention to the words and the promises of Christ, which you hear from me and you see in the things that we're doing.
I mentioned before remembering the ordination vow that I made 15-some-odd years ago. I remember the ordination sermon, too. The seminary professor, Bill Schmelder, who came in and preached at my ordination, the one thing I remember from his sermon is he told the congregation, these guys are interchangeable. Mm-hmm. This is your latest guy. The congregation had had dozens of pastors over its long, 150-year history. And he said, you should have learned by now that these guys are interchangeable, but they all bring the same indispensable message of Christ and Him crucified. What are pastors truly interchangeable?
Well, humbling, isn't it? In a certain sense, yes. Yes, they are, because in those tasks that we are given to do, in the forgiveness we speak, in the sacraments we deliver, you know, it's really not us. You know, it's like when somebody makes a big deal about, well, you know, I want Pastor so-and-so to do the baptism because, you know, he means so much to me. And you can understand that, but in the end, you know, what's important is not who does the baptizing, but it's Christ who really does the baptizing. It's not me, you know, but Christ who delivers them. So yes, you know, we are interchangeable. We all bring special things to different situations, and we're not all meant for the same parish. You know, one person might do well in Iowa and not in New York City, but when you get down to it, when you boil it all down, in a certain sense, yes, we are.
Along with a different view of the pastor's work, and we've mentioned this already in our conversation, does that bring with it essentially a different view of the church itself?
Yes. Hold on just a second. Say that again. I'm not sure I caught what your point was.
Well, if the pastor is, rather than shepherd or preacher and administrator of the sacraments, if he is rather than CEO or grand organizer, efficiency expert,
yes.
What different view of the church does that bring?
Right. Oh, it makes a huge difference. If the pastor is all of those things, then the church is no longer a place where we go to get forgiveness, a place where we meet Christ and are joined with Christ, where our faith is strengthened, and we go then and with our faith strengthened by these by the gospel, where we then go out and joyfully serve in our vocations and so forth. The church then becomes a place where you know, we we somehow have to do things, or it's a place where, you know, we're achieving things and we're doing things, and the focus is taken off of the Christ who is present and who gives and promises and forgives, and the focus is put on us and what we are achieving, doing, growing. And what happens in that switch, you know, and it may be subtle, and it may not be a, you know, complete switch, but, you know, our comfort is going away, and the gospel is being weakened and is being obscured. So, and it's a whole different view of the church, absolutely.
You've also written this. I found this somewhat amusing because I know exactly what you're talking about when you write, "Sometimes the most important thing I do all week as a pastor is stand in the shower and realize that my sermon has no gospel in it, and I'd better dump it in the trash and rewrite it. That insight, which takes a moment, might be the most valuable, cost-effective work I do all week." What do you mean?
Well, it's a strange... You know, we have a strange occupation, pastors. I mean, some jobs, you know, it's a matter of applying yourself and you know, hammering nails or typing or entering data or going to meetings. And as long as you do those tasks and put in a certain... I mean, you're going to do it. Whereas a pastor, often those things are involved, putting in time certainly, but, you know, it's strange, you know, if you're thinking about your sermon, I mean, you may sit for 3 hours and not that it's mystical or whatever, but, you know, you may write a sermon and then, you know, be driving to the hospital somewhere or in the shower and realize, you know, that you went off on the wrong direction, that you were angry at the congregation or you missed the central point of the text, and you know, that might just take an instant of when you know, your study or your you know, kind of chewing on the verses kind of hits you, but then, you know, that insight is valuable and may only take a moment. So it's, you know, sometimes you're working when you're not even working, or the Holy Spirit is working in you, you know, with that word that you're kind of mashing around in your head.
St. Paul writes about the need to support the preaching of the gospel. And although he takes some kind of a strange, humble pride in the fact that he himself accepted nothing in return for the preaching of the gospel, he's adamant with those who read his epistles that a worker is worthy of his wage.
Mm-hmm.
How should we view this paycheck the pastor gets? Is it compensation for services rendered like any other job?
Well, not really. I mean, yes and no. In other words, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, if you're looking at it from the viewpoint of the minister, of the pastor, you know, the pastor ought not charge to forgive sins. The pastor doesn't charge, I'm going to send you a bill, you know, to baptize your child. From the point of view of the pastor, no, the pastor does this because God has called him into the ministry, and this is his solemn duty before God and his joyful duty before God to do these things. That is what he is. He is a pastor, and that's what he does on account of the gospel. Viewed from the relation of the congregation, of course, the congregation, as you say, has a responsibility to take care of the pastor and to make sure that his needs are met and his family, if he has one. And that's their joyful duty. As, you know, you've mentioned ordination, and the congregation traditionally makes some promises at an installation or an ordination. And so that's their joyful duty to take care of the pastor, and they're doing it in all Christian work and service, in thanks to God for what God does through that man, so you know, it's both hand, but it depends how you look at it, I guess.
About a year ago, I was looking at a survey that had been taken. I think it was from the website beliefnet.com, and they had surveyed pastors, senior pastors of all denominations across the United States, and they had determined that the pay for pastors, when compared with other professionals of equal education and whatnot, came out to about 40% of what the average person with an equal education would make in any other profession, 40%. So are we underpaying our pastors given the great gravity of the task that they do among us?
Well, I think pastors should be paid as much as congregations are able to pay them. And, you know, yeah, probably, maybe, you know, it's...
Why do you hesitate, Pastor Holmes? And I don't want to make this question personal.
Right.
But why, that's the kind of question that if someone were to put it to me, I would give exactly the same kind of, I don't know kind of answer. Why the hesitation?
I think maybe it's because as pastors we don't want to appear greedy, I guess, and I mean not that we're making, you know, not that we're being false or anything when we do this. It's a good question. I don't know why. I mean, yeah, objectively so, if I'm thinking about pastors and the level of education and the pastors I know and that work tremendously hard and in a difficult occupation that, as you said, has less and less respect, and takes a large amount of education to that we bring to it, and yeah, by all objective standards, we should. On the other hand, if we don't get into this stuff, into this job, into this call, we don't go to the seminary for money. We do it because God has called us, because God has planted in us a love of the gospel and hopefully a love of people, and that's why we do it. So, if I was talking to a room full of parishioners, I would say, pay your pastor more if you're not paying him enough. Make sure he's taken care of. And if I was talking to a room of pastors, I would say, preach the gospel.
And be satisfied with what you're paid. All right, finally, with 1 minute, what should a layperson look for in a proper pastor?
A layperson should look for a love of the truth and a love of the gospel in a pastor. A pastor who loves the scriptural truth, who loves proclaiming it, and a pastor who loves to forgive sins and to deliver that message, wherever he can. Those two things, the love of truth, which is what guarantees that gospel, those are the two things I would say would be top of the list. I mean, there's a host of others, but that love of truth and that love of the gospel, that desire to feed the people with the forgiveness of Christ.
Pastor Greg Holmes is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Catawba, North Carolina. He is author of the blog Incarnatus Est. You can find it. I'm not going to spell it because it's one of those that has a Latin name, but you can type into a search engine, Google or whatever you want, Lutheran blogs. You'll find there in amongst things a Lutheran blog directory, and you scroll down, you're going to find Incarnatus Est. It's the blog by Pastor Greg Holmes. It's well worth reading. He's also written an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled In His Stead on being paid to act like Jesus. Pastor Holmes, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
We come back from this break, spend some time with Bob Leko talking about the signs and wonders movement of today.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Larry Rast, Arthur Just, Carl Fakencher, Kurt Marquardt, Peter Scare, Cameron McKenzie.
You probably recognize these names as regular guests on Issues, Etc. But what else do they have in common? Well, they're all members of the Christ-centered, cross-focused faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Dean Wenthe, Walter A. Meyer II, David Scare, Dan Gard, Charles Geeshan, Bill Weinrich.
Have you ever considered the pastoral ministry? Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call them 1-800-481-2155. Preparing Christ-centered, cross-focused pastors for the 21st century. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
John Pless, Hal Senkbeil, Richard Muller, Roland Ziegler.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Flag burning came into vogue during the Vietnam War and continues to be one of the most offensive forms of protest aimed at our government and its policies. Congress is trying to take control of flag burning once and for all with a constitutional amendment. Steve Jordahl reports the debate pits the freedom of expression against a cherished symbol of freedom.
Along with hot dogs and apple pie, baseball is quintessential Americana. But on a sunny Sunday in April 1976, Dodger announcer Vin Scully called one of the most unusual, and some say heroic, plays in Major League history.
And wait a minute, there's an animal loose. It looks like he's going to burn a flag, and Rick Monday runs and takes it away from him. I think a guy was going to set fire to the American flag. Can you imagine that?
Utah Senator Orrin Hatch can't. He's sponsoring the amendment. Roger Pilon of the Cato Institute says it runs afoul of the First Amendment.
Good speech, speech that is inoffensive, doesn't really need to be defended. It's the right to engage in unpopular speech that needs to be defended.
But Jay Sekulow of the American Center for Law and Justice says the flag is such an important symbol, it deserves special protection.
The American flag is representative of the best of what America is, and I think there are some symbols that should be so protected that they should not be held in that kind of effigy.
The amendment has passed the House for 6 years running, but can't get through the Senate. David Barton of Wall Builders says this time is different.
There's just a real sense of loving America and patriotism, and I think this is a very likely time to get it passed.
While lawyers are divided on the issue, Barton says polls show most Americans think the amendment would be a great play. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
The amendment would not outlaw flag burning, but would give Congress the power to prohibit it. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Benjamin Franklin was many things in addition to his being the only American to sign all five founding documents of the United States. He would have celebrated his 300th birthday this year, and the Missouri Historical Society marks the occasion by welcoming the international traveling exhibition, Benjamin Franklin, In Search of a Better World, to the History Museum in Forest Park on June 9th. This massive effort to bring the man and his accomplishments to life will remain on display until September 4th. Visit mohistory.org to find out more.
Reasonable Ethics, a Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns, is the title of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Reasonable Ethics on our website, issuesetc.org. Reasonable Ethics by Dr. Robert Benny, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Having a little trouble getting a hold of Bob Leko, and hopefully we'll be able to schedule him a little later in the day today. We will have a little audio open lines for you just ahead. Very interesting story out of New York. Hasn't made to the New York Supreme Court yet, but to one of the levels of the appeals court in New York, an issue of gay marriage and gay marriage licenses in that state. We'll have that for you in just a moment. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's a new month. It's a new book. It's called Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns. There's always this tension, and there always will be, for the individual Christian, for the church as a whole, on how to address political, social, and economic issues, because they have ethical and moral components to them. And there are places where God's Word speaks very clearly, and therefore the church and the Christian must speak. And then there are places where God's Word does not speak clearly, and there the church and the Christian must employ their better judgment, even on some moral issues. That's the essence of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, called Reasonable Ethics. You can find out more about the book at our website, issuesetc.org, or you can order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The website address, again, you'll find the book right there, and you can browse before you buy, issuesetc.org. New York State's highest court heard arguments Wednesday in several gay marriage cases. It will be at least a month before the New York Court of Appeals decides whether gays and lesbians have the right to marry same-sex partners. The story is interesting. This would make New York the second state to seriously consider whether or not to legalize, in one form or another, gay marriage. Here's the story from National Public Radio.
Yesterday, the justices heard arguments from advocates representing more than 40 same-sex couples. They were denied marriage licenses. If the court rules in their favor, New York could move closer to being the second state to allow same-sex marriages. NPR's Robert Smith reports.
It was more than 2 years ago that Joanne Shane and Mary Jo Kennedy dressed for their wedding day. The two women showed up at the New York City clerk's office, plopped down their money for a marriage license, and were politely turned down.
We brought our cameras and took pictures of it. And afterwards, actually, I sent out announcements via email to my various friends. It was instead of a wedding announcement, it was a denial of wedding announcement, you know.
Now the New York State Court of Appeals will finally decide if that denial was constitutional. Outside the Albany courthouse yesterday afternoon, same-sex couples from around the state who also had been refused licenses lined up to attend the oral arguments. The court had consolidated four separate lawsuits.
We're actually today introducing ourselves to the couples from other cases that we don't know.
We've never met them before, and it's nice to meet some of the other plaintiffs.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.
Inside the courtroom, the justices were using the case to explore the history of marriage. From, as one judge put it, the dawn of civilization, to the very recent debate over no-fault divorces. Advocates for the same-sex couples tried to make a very simple case, that the state's 97-year-old marriage law, which refers to husband and wife, doesn't live up to modern standards of equal protection under the law. Terrence Kindlin is one of the lawyers for the same-sex couples.
We are evolving as a society. And just because we did something 200 years ago or 100 years ago or 50 years ago, it's not necessarily a good justification to do it now.
I agree with you entirely.
Court of Appeals Justice George Bundy Smith.
And in that circumstance, shouldn't we leave it to the legislature to deal with it?
It's my position that we don't need the legislature.
Kindlin made the case that the terms husband and wife only needed to be changed to spouse to solve the problem. Besides, the New York State legislature, the advocates argued, is too slow and unwilling to adopt change. Protection of minorities, they said, has to come from the court. Attorneys for the state and city of New York, who were defending the marriage law, disagreed. Marriage is a contract, they said, and the legislature sets the terms of that contract. Peter Schiff, with the New York Attorney General's office, argued that the state legislature has a reason to protect heterosexual marriage.
It hasn't been historically that just because two people love each other, it's because there has been this relation to the possibility of procreation.
If this all sounds familiar, it's because this is how the legal debate played out in the Massachusetts Supreme Court in 2003. There, the justices decided that the state had no rational basis for denying same-sex couples the right to marry. Roberta Kaplan, a lawyer for the gay and lesbian couples, told the court that it turned out the Massachusetts justices were right.
There's not people rioting in the streets in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. There's not a breakdown of civil society in Massachusetts. And there surely isn't a breakdown of marriage in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
The New York Court of Appeals isn't expected to rule on the case for at least a month. And even then, there could be something in between full marriage rights and denial. A couple of the justices asked whether civil unions would solve the issue, although neither side seemed to favor a compromise solution. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
All right, there's a story from National Public Radio. You will notice that, and I think this is probably worth watching as the modus operandi for the advocates of gay marriage moving ahead state by state. And don't think you're safe just because you're sitting in the Midwest. Think about Wisconsin, okay? You don't get more Midwest than the state of Wisconsin, and it is not it's not a leap of credulity to picture in the next 10 years a group of lesbian or gay couples coming to Madison's courthouse, walking up there saying, look, we'd like our marriage licenses, please. Feigning naivete, you mean we can't have marriage licenses here? We love each other. They come ready with the cameras, all dressed up, hoping to get their marriage license, knowing full well that they're going to be denied a marriage license. And then they have a ready-made case to make. Heck, if, you know what they say about New York, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. And if they can make it there, Wisconsin or Missouri or Illinois is not a giant leap. But the way this happens is not, it's a generated case. And the amazing thing I found in this piece was the attorney for the plaintiffs here who want their gay marriage licenses very clearly said the legislature is too slow, the legislature is not going to get this job done, it's too cumbersome, the courts have to decide. The courts have to say what this state will or will not allow by way of gay marriage. You're watching there, and we should watch closely, the game plan for pushing gay marriage state by state. I'm convinced of that. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines for your reaction to the next step there in New York for gay marriage in the United States. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, feel free to use that here in the next 30 minutes. issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're coming to you live this Thursday. It's the 1st of June. These are odd little things. I've seen a couple of these actually in the in video stores, Christian video games. Some of them are kind of set in the mystical medieval time, and you'll have the forces of good and the forces of evil. There was one that I think was based upon doing spiritual warfare, so you could play as an angel against an army of demons. The latest, it hasn't been released yet, is loosely based on the Left Behind series of books. The scenario in the game is it's after the rapture, the so-called secret rapture, and there are some Christians who, well, they haven't been left behind, they've been converted after they were left behind. The task is to convert people during the 7-year tribulation. That's what's got to happen. That's the scenario of the game. Here's the story from MSNBC on this particular Christian video game.
Video games are frequently a target for family values groups. Critics question the violence and language often used in games, especially for teenagers. But one new game has some of those critics looking at their own community. It's a Christian game based on a popular book series. Senior producer Tony Macillas has this story. Fill us in, Tony.
Yeah, Allison, you know, this was the top story over at Boing Boing for a while, so I did a little digging just to see who else was talking about it. Turns out it's a huge story out there. The video game isn't even out yet. It doesn't come out actually until Christmas, but bloggers are already all over this. They call it the latest move in the culture war, a game of grabbing guns for God.
Video game sales totaled $10 billion last year, and the top seller was Grand Theft Auto. It's known for graphic violence. At this year's Electronic Entertainment Expo, a new game debuted. It involves a graphic battle as well, but this one is for your soul.
God will come to take his people home.
The game Left Behind Eternal Forces is based on the popular book series Left Behind by Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins. The premise is the same. The end of the world has come, and God has separated believers from non-believers. The object of the game, you need to convert non-believers or kill them. Some on the web and elsewhere question violence in a game created for Christian youth. Conservative attorney Jack Thompson opposes the game. He says the church should be trying to change pop culture, not contribute to the violence we see around us. Game reviewers like this one say the game is well made, but it does involve Christian good guys killing armies of non-believers. The game's creators are responding to their critics, saying that while Christians learn to turn the other cheek, they must not forfeit their lives to aggressors.
Now, those creators actually bought the rights to Left Behind from the book publisher. The publisher actually has a statement out about the game already. That publisher is saying that we should wait until the game is released to criticize it, but that the game creators are solely responsible for its content. And that sounds like passing the buck to me, but I will wait and see the game.
That sounds like a lawyer read that statement.
Yes,
Tony,
thanks
so much.
All right, there's a story from MSNBC. It is amusing, of course. Good rule of thumb, if your theology fits on a bumper sticker, you might want to think again about your theology. If your theology can be turned into a comic book, you might want to rethink your theology. If your theology can be turned into a video game, and I love video games, but if it can be turned into a video game, you might want to rethink it. I want to hear from you on the Left Behind video game coming out Christmas. Plan to get it for your kids? Kill the unbelievers. Very simple scenario. Most of these games are. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We do have a scheduled interview with Tim LaHaye himself Monday on issues, etc. Looking forward to that, and I'm sure you are as well. What do you think about the video game based upon his very popular, best-selling, one-of-a-kind series of books, The Left Behind series? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And what else would you do in a video game scenario after God has raptured all the Christians? Kill the unbelievers. You either convert them or kill them. I found it odd that the spokesman for the video game publisher said, well, you know, while Christians should learn to turn the other cheek, they should not lay down their lives in the face of aggressors. Strikes me that's what Christians were doing for at least a couple centuries at the beginning of the church, laying down their lives for the faith in the face of aggressors. In fact, we'll be talking about one of them coming up here in just about 10 or 15 minutes, Justin Martyr. I wonder if he appears in that video game. Now, that would be a video game. Maybe someone has already developed that. You know, in fact, maybe I just dreamt it. I don't know. You could call it Colosseum or Gladiator or Christians versus the Romans or something like that. It would be bloody, because the truth of the story is pretty bloody. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issues etc@kfuo.org. Chris writes this from Carson City, Nevada. Okay, granted, I'm 24 and have no real responsibilities in life, but I will at least rent, if not buy, the Left Behind video game for the same reason I will see Snakes on a Plane in theaters. What in the world is Snakes on a Plane? Who knows? Well, see, you could tell that I'm completely out of things. I'm not 24. I do have real responsibilities. It looks, he writes, it looks utterly and completely retarded, he says. I'm surprised you're just hearing about this. Hey, look, I'm 42. Takes forever for us to hear about it, if we hear about it at all. I had to turn up my hearing aid to get that one. The trailer has been online for months. Yeah, the amount of time I'm able to spend online with two kids during the school year. Remember, there are three types of people in this world, writes Chris. Those who seek a relationship with God, those who don't, and those who choose to ignore God. This game is going to be amazingly bad. I'm so excited. Chris writes from Carson City, Nevada. A fellow gamer. Yeah, the bad ones are sometimes as amusing as the good ones. But as I said, the amount of time I'm able to spend at the computer, I've had a game that I've been playing through. It came out like 2 years ago. I'm still playing through this thing. My brother, my little brother, will play through a game in 3 nights, staying up late. It takes me 3 years. So I'll probably be renting the Left Behind video game just to see what it's like sometime around 2010. I'll tell you what it was like. But Chris, if you want to tell us what it was like around Christmas time, feel free to do so. Steve writes this in West County. How is the Christianity that this game represents different from militant Islam? Not much, he says. Well, it's true, except this. That according to the makers of the game, after the rapture that everyone is supposedly waiting for, Christians apparently will have to defend themselves. I'm sure that this will be couched as some sort of a defensive, killing the unbeliever to defend oneself. Oh, it's very exciting. If you read the Left Behind series, the Christians actually, they're flying around in planes, tanks, you name it, because the Antichrist is out to kill all of them. I remember the words of the book of Revelation. Jesus says, "Be faithful thou unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." I think part of the task, if their scenario were true, part of the task of Christians in that tribulation would be to die. At least that's what Jesus seems to say. It's open lines for the next 10 minutes of issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Speaking of militant Islam, in Turkey, often touted as the most democratic and least Islamist of the Islamic countries, a very familiar issue is being raised. This comes from CNN It's the headscarf controversy in Turkey.
Daily life in Istanbul. Fishermen cram the bridges looking for the perfect catch. A multitude of mosques and minarets rising above them on the skyline of this secular society. But as religious and non-religious mix easily among Istanbul's famous tourist spots, modern and traditional attitudes do not. The clearest sign of polarization is the controversy over how women should dress. For Dilek Golet, the clash between state and religion cost her her career as a doctor. In 1999, she was excluded from university because she refused to remove her headscarf. Headscarves are also banned in government buildings and hospitals.
In front of the doors, always there was police, and we couldn't attend the lessons, we couldn't attend the exams. In the end, there were so many protests, but it didn't change the situation.
After 6 months, she gave up even going to the front gates. This interpretation of secular, Golet says, signifies an abuse of her religious rights.
It is not necessary to be ruled by the Sharia or Islamic rules. It is just enough to respect freedoms and rights of others. You can support the secular system, but if you respect others' rights and freedoms, you can survive.
But the secular left fears the influence of the ruling party. The Prime Minister's Justice and Development Party has Islamist roots. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he has fully adopted secularism and democracy. But others, like writer, artist and staunch secularist Bedri Baykam, say Turkey is facing a soft religious revolution. He fears that if the lines between religion and state are blurred, the political system in Turkey will be compromised. He already believes Islamists want women wearing headscarves in government.
Not because they want women to go into politics, but because they want Islam to be there present and defying the secular democratic society. So they want it as a flag, that's all. It's a game.
Both sides, I think you are using the headscarves. One is saving us from the scarf, the other is supporting the scarf. But both sides are not sincere in this issue.
When the modern Turkish Republic was born in 1923, headscarves were banned completely. It took decades for that ban to be lifted, and in recent years, an increasing number of Muslim women are choosing to cover their heads. Whether it's a religious right or a political statement, this one piece of fabric now epitomizes the ongoing clash in Turkey between religion and state. Paula Hancock, CNN, Istanbul.
Now the tension here, of course, is that strictly speaking, Islam does not recognize a line between the state and the religion. The two are one. Islam is government. It's God's government. It is as pure a theocracy as anyone can imagine. Or I guess we should say, in real terms, it's actually not so much a theocracy. What would you call something that is, surely you have a bright enough listener to inform me, what do you call something where the clergy rule? It's not a theocracy, strictly speaking. There's a name for it. I forget what it is. So here's the real tension. In Turkey, you're trying to do democracy of a kind. And at the same time, the majority religion, one might even say the only really truly tolerated religion in the country, Islam, simply doesn't recognize a division between church and state. Sharia law is God's law. It's not just civil law. We call it civil law. They call it God's law. And when the clergy speak, that carries civil authority with it. Whether you love or hate or are ambivalent about the American tension of the separation of church and state, it exists. Everyone believes in it to one degree or another. They do. Even Christians who say there's no such thing as separation of church and state still believe in the separation of church and state to one degree or another. They do not believe that the government ought to be able to dictate on religious terms what they believe and how they behave, that the government should not be able to bind their conscience as to what they believe. That's a separation of church and state, like it or not. But in Islam, there is no such separation at all. So what do you do when the government tries to encourage women to wear headscarves? They say because it's more of a political statement, when you can't separate political and religious statements from one another. Are we watching this experiment that is Turkey, less than 100 years old, as a democracy and an Islamic nation, come to an end? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Headscarves as they were in Europe, I think it was France last year that headscarves became the big issue, are indeed a symbol for something far greater. It's not just the role of women in society, it's the role of Islam in a society. And it looks all very foreign to us and all very exotic to us. In France, what did they do? They said no headscarves in French schools. And people said, well, that's an infringement on our religious liberty. And Christians said, well, maybe it is, but what if it isn't just a headscarf, isn't just a headscarf and a religious expression? What if it is a political expression? That France ought to be part of the world of Islam. Parts of it were one time. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. This summer is going to be exciting because much of the faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, will be coming, one of them at least, will be coming to a city near you this summer for an opportunity for continuing education. This isn't just for pastors or professional theologians, it's for lay people too. Dr. Larry Rast, one of our favorite guests here on the program, near the end of June is going to be teaching on the formative influences of American Christianity in Norwalk, Connecticut. Dr. Kurt Marquard is going to be talking about modern apologetics and the Lutheran ministry debate in the middle of June in San Francisco, California. Let's see what else is happening there. The Theology of the Cross, Pastor John Pless will be teaching in Salt Lake City, Utah on that in July. And then in Kearney, Nebraska, Dr. Carl Fekencher, another great guest here on the program in mid-July, teaching on law and gospel in today's sermons. All that and more. They're sending out almost their entire faculty and a good number of them guests here on Issues, etc., for continuing education opportunities for you this summer. For more information, you can call them, area code 260-452-2266, 260-452-2266. Or visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on these continuing education courses from Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. When we come back from this break, we'll talk about Justin Martyr with Dr. Richard Stuckwish.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.